Thank you, Matt, and thank you to everybody again for joining us for this virtual town hall. We've done a few of these now. We appreciate all of your interest and the questions that you submit. I think they're super thoughtful. And so let me go ahead and kick us off. As we've done with the previous town halls, we want to give you the latest information about what we're seeing, how we're reacting, what we're planning for, and some of the latest news. And so today, that'll be, we'll start with the data, as we've done before, both from a tracking the testing results standpoint and how many patients we have in our system. I know many of you have expressed interest in that. And then I'll wrap up with some comments around reintroducing some of the non-emergent procedures and visits, which we just started to do. Give you a little more information about that, and then we'll turn it over to Q&A. So just to start with the data and the information, this is information numbers through May 13th, so a couple days. We tested over 18,000 people thus far, so that number continues to go steadily upwards. And as I mentioned previously, we are still criteria-based, although have some more flexibility around being able to test certain higher risk populations who may not have the same symptoms and meet the traditional criteria. And so we've continued to expand that. Of those that we test, we see about 16% test positive. That's consistent with the 15 to 18% range that we've always been hovering around. And of those who test positive, we see about 18% of them getting admitted overall. And that too has stayed pretty consistent throughout since mid-March when we first started seeing COVID-positive patients. That means we've admitted about 480 patients thus far across all of the hospitals in our system, and we've discharged about 380 of them. 100 folks were able to be discharged from the ICU. That's a lot of people recovering to the point that they no longer need that intensive care. So big, big testament to the efforts and work of our team. And then lastly, it's important, as I've reinforced previously, it's important, and these numbers show that a significant number of folks, first of all, don't have the disease. And then of those who do, a significant number don't require hospitalization. And of those who do land in the hospital, a bulk of them don't require ICU level care. And so I think that's important to keep in mind. But at the same time, remember that the disease is out there in the community. We know that it's got community prevalence and existence. And so we all need to continue to be careful. And that's, in fact, the message that we've tried to continue to emphasize. A couple key milestones, both our GWV and GCMC campuses, just in the last 10 days or so, have seen their 100th patient discharge. So a lot of people making great recoveries. And also last Friday, so a week ago today, was the first day that we had below 100 people admitted across all of our campuses. And earlier this week was the first day in over 3 weeks that we had less than 90 people admitted across all of our campuses. And believe it or not, today, we drifted even lower. And so those trends continue to head in the right direction. We have at this point about 80 or so patients in our hospitals, and about 30 of them are in the ICU. I believe the number as of today is 34. We have seen 90 or 95 deaths across our system. So obviously, a reminder that this is still a very serious illness, very serious virus. And obviously also our condolences go out to each of those families because the impact is profound. It's important to remember that while we're heading in the right direction as a community, we're still not out of the woods, and the implications clinically for those who do have the virus and do get sick with it can be about as serious as any other illness you can imagine. As far as our employees, we have 27,000 employees in the Pennsylvania side of our operation, and we've seen about 130 of them test positive, and that's less than 1% of the total pool. And of those that we test, I think it's important to continue to track that our employees test positive at about half the rate that the rest of the population that we test ends up testing positive. So that's reassuring. that our safety precautions are indeed having the desired impact. We've had 7 of our employees hospitalized, 6 have made a full recovery and have been discharged, and 1 is still in the hospital, and we hope that they continue to do well. As we mentioned before, there's a little bit of tale of two cities as far as the dynamics between different areas within the region that we serve. The Northeast has seen a decrease after having that early spike in early and mid-April, and since then kind of plateaued, and we've finally started to see a downward trend, which is very reassuring. In the other areas that we serve, we always knew that the peak would be further out, and our projections currently show that the peaks won't be as high as we had initially projected, which is also good news. I think it underscores the fact that the dynamic of this virus is a very local one, which means you have to track the activity level of the virus in any given county to really get a good picture of what's going on there. Because of course, if you look at a statewide level, it's skewed. The data tends to be skewed by areas that are hotspots. In much the same way that if you look at a nationwide data set, that number tends to be skewed, or those trends tend to be skewed by the New York experience. So we try to get as local as possible with the data. We've been emphasizing the distancing and prevention measures, both within our organization, but also out in the community, because we know that as segments of society continue to open up, and as we reintroduce some of the services that we had previously rescheduled, this needs to happen gradually, it needs to happen phased, and we've used the analogy that it is like a dimmer and not like a light switch. Also important to remember that even after you have this peak and start trending down, we still have new cases every single day, and so that's a good reminder that the disease and the virus are still out there, alive and well, and we have to make and take all the precautions that we've been talking about before. So that's a little bit about the data on the testing and both on the patient side. Wanted to also talk to you about some good news as far as reintroducing some of the services that we had previously postponed. As you all recall, I believe this was mid to late March, we had postponed the non-emergent procedures and also clinic visits. And much like many other health systems, this was done to allow us time to focus on staffing, preparedness, clear out capacity, whether it's bed capacity or ventilator capacity or what have you, to make sure that our readiness efforts for a potential surge were where they needed to be. I think some questions that we have gotten, I think it's worth a reminder, that throughout this whole time, we've never postponed clinically urgent cases or clinically urgent appointments, because of course those carry an urgency, a time urgency, and we didn't want to delay those because first and foremost, we're here to make sure that people get the care that they need. And so those have always been going on, but what we're talking about now is reintroducing some of the things that at that time were not as emergent, not as urgent, and now we're in a position to be able to do that. We just started about a week ago in a phased approach, not dependent on any specific date or target. We're trying to take it in a phased approach and stay nimble, taking into account things like the activity level of the virus in the local community, taking into account our bed capacity in the local area and system-wide. Take into account the staffing and making sure that we have the ability to have the right level of skills in the right places. And then, of course, the clinical need of the services themselves, equipment, a whole host of things go into these considerations. And all the while, we've made sure that we're staying really nimble in case we do see a resurgence of virus activity, whether now or sometime in the future. We need to make sure that we're nimble, and that's how we've approached the situation. It's also to try to address care that can't be put off any longer. I've used the examples before, the person with the gallbladder and the gallstones in the gallbladder, those things don't go away, and it causes pain, it causes symptoms, it subjects that person to a risk of infection. And so periodically, we make sure that we're touching base with these patients throughout the entire time they've been waiting to make sure that their disease states have not progressed, because if there's any hint of progression, obviously that becomes a more urgent need, and we're bringing those folks in faster. We're going to continue to monitor the criteria that I talked about as a way to stay nimble and be able to react quickly as circumstances change. The other note that I think is worth mentioning, we've gotten some questions around this term that some of you may have heard, the term COVID-free. And I think it's important here, and it's an opportunity to reinforce that we're a data and science-driven organization, and it's important, especially in times like these, to revert back to the science. And here's what the science tells us. The science tells us that the virus is out there in the community. It's pretty widely prevalent, and that means that it can show up anytime, any place, in any body. And if it can show up in those ways, oftentimes it even shows up without that person being aware that they have it. And so for us, rather than potentially introduce a false sense of security, we focused our efforts on safety, on precautions, on prevention across all of our campuses at every site, because you can't be too careful with this thing. And some of the precautions that we've taken, and we've walked you through this before, but we have separate treatment areas for every COVID patient on all of our campuses. And that means it's a dedicated staff and a dedicated unit, and that separation creates safety. We've also focused on screening and masking anybody who walks in the door at any of our campuses, and that also creates safety. At the same time, our staff wear the appropriate PPE for the roles that they're in, which also creates more safety. And as we've reopened some of these functions, whether it's the clinics or the procedure areas, we're doing so in a way that also creates even more safety. You've seen, those of you that have been on our campuses recently, you've seen the tents. That's a good illustration of creating separation and different areas for evaluation. But also, as you see our waiting rooms, chairs spaced further apart, clinic appointments being staggered throughout the day so that there's much fewer, if any, people ever needing to be in the waiting room. Cleaning and disinfecting that's regularly done after each and every patient and regularly throughout the day otherwise. And at the same time, changing workflows so that people are less likely to come into contact with high-touch surface areas. There's a whole slew of things along these lines. I've just rattled off a few, and we've described them to you before, but those are the things that will make each and every site COVID safe. And so that's the way that we've thought about it and why we've approached it the way that we have. The other thing is, as we reopen some of these clinics, you'll notice that our hours are longer. And that's so that we can space out appointments throughout the day, much like you're seeing with the grocery stores. That means that folks in particular who may be at a higher risk kind of pool because of their chronic diseases, they have access to those visits at different times of the day where there truly is less traffic. And of course, our use of telemedicine has just skyrocketed. You know, before COVID, we were probably doing 100 or so or even less telemedicine visits per day. At this point, we're up above 4,000, approaching 5,000 visits per day through telemedicine. And that offers the convenience for people to get the care they need in the home, but also allows our providers to stay in contact with their patients and make sure things are not progressing and that their needs are taken care of. I think it's also important, and you've heard us say this before, that we really are all in this together. I think that's important to remember in particular as we reopen things. Now is not the time to ease up on these preventive measures. And we've been really emphasizing that with all of the folks in the community. We need to remain diligent, whether it's distancing or masking or hand hygiene or other things. And some of the reminders that I always leave you with, and you're probably sick of hearing me say these things, but please, please stay home unless there's something essential, or, you know, exercise or getting into the outdoors. I think those things are fair. Obviously, going to the grocery store. But things that you don't absolutely need, now's not the time to do those things. Washing your hands often, I think that's another thing that we can't emphasize enough. It's amazing that something so simple has time and time again proven to be among the most effective ways to thwart the virus. Try not to touch your face. And believe it or not, we all subconsciously do it, myself included. but I think that's a habit that's good to get into. Keeping surfaces clean, I think being that germaphobe nowadays is probably a good way to be, whether it's in your kitchen, in your home, in your workplace, anywhere you go. And then giving back wherever you can, if you can, and checking in on your neighbors. I think that's the other thing that I would leave you all with. There are a lot of folks in need. This is a difficult time, and it's hitting some folks harder than others. And I think it's a good reason to make sure that those folks are okay. So I'll turn it back to you, Matt, and see if we have any questions.
We do. Thank you, Dr. Rue. First from WNEP and WKOK Radio is about remdesivir, and Geisinger received a shipment earlier this week. Can you say how much we received and how we are using it?
Yeah, so I think remdesivir, it's an antiviral medication. For those of you who may not know, it's gotten picked up in the media because some of the clinical trials, the early evidence has come back with some reassuring evidence that people might recover faster as a result of the use of the medication, or at least that their hospital stays for those who are in the hospital gets shortened. Now, what it didn't study is whether mortality, i.e. the outcome of does someone live or die, is any better or worse. So I think we have to take the results with a little bit of grain of salt. But that being said, it stands to reason that there's some good evidence to suggest that it's effective. What came about as a result of those results was that the federal government, the Department of Health and Human Services, are managing the distribution of the medication because, of course, they want the medication to go to areas of greatest need. And so they've been working with each of the state's departments of health to figure out a distribution plan. And just yesterday or the day before, we got our first shipment through the Pennsylvania Department of Health. And at four of our hospital campuses here in Pennsylvania, we received enough treatment for three patients at each site. So a total of three across each of the four campuses that received them. So 12 patients worth of treatments. We expect another shipment today, and I think they're going to continue to get that out. So I think a good indicator of the fact that, you know, the science is emerging and we're adding tools to our toolbox to be able to battle this thing, and remdesivir is one of those tools.
Next question is from the Daily Item and the Press Enterprise. Are there more specifics or timeframes you can share on returning elective or non-emergency procedures across the system, and what procedures have resumed and where?
So I referenced a little bit of this earlier, Matt, but I think our approach, and it's probably easier to talk about approach because it hasn't been specific to a certain procedure or others, because each individual patient, the circumstances can be very different. I use the example of gallstones. Gallstones in one patient may be fine for a while. In another, it may be a very urgent need. And so we're assessing that patient by patient, led by our clinicians and our physicians. We haven't tried to adhere to a certain time deadline. I know some places have put, you know, by this date we're going to do this and this date we do that, but we've been steadily phasing. And I'll give you an example. Here on this campus in Danville at our flagship, we had 17 of our 31 or 32 ORs open 2 weeks ago. Last week we phased that up to 20 of our 31 or 32 ORs were open. And this week, we opened up 25 of our 31 ORs. And so you could see that gradually we're creating more capacity and easing back in to allow for the cases that have subsequently become more urgent, but also to steadily introduce the things that are that were previously postponed that were more of an elective nature. And so we're doing that. At the same time, as I mentioned before, we're balancing a whole host of considerations, the big one being bed capacity and making sure we have the beds to accommodate these patients if the procedure is one that would require a bed. A lot of these procedures are things that people come in and they could go home subsequently later in the day. And those are probably the easiest ones to do because there isn't as much of a bed need. But we're also balancing things like staffing, equipment, and the activity level of the virus in a given community. And so that's why our Northeast facilities, the reintroduction of the services, it will also happen, but probably on a slightly slower pace than what we're going to see here in Central or in our Western or North Central areas.
The next question, three-parter from WKOK Radio and the Press Enterprise. As our area is yellow and other counties go that way against governor orders, have you experienced any increase in COVID-19 or do you anticipate an increase? Also, do you have a reaction to Columbia County's announcement to go yellow ahead of the governor's announcement? And do you feel specifically Geisinger Medical Center, Geisinger Bloomsburg Hospital have enough staffing beds and equipment to support a county moving to yellow ahead of governor orders?
Yeah, so there's a lot there. You did like a threefer on me there. But I think the first answer is we have a lot of data that we're tracking, and it's not just the number of patients on our campuses. It's also the number of patients testing positive, and you heard me go through some of that earlier. We graph that and we track it, and the reason why is because we know that that's a leading indicator. When we see a spike in the number of cases that test positive, we could pretty much predict that within the next week or two after that, we'll see a spike in the number of patients that we have admitted in our hospitals with COVID. What's been reassuring is really since mid-April or so, after we had a spike across our area, as far as the number of patients who were testing positive, we've seen that steadily come down, and it continues to come down. Now, what that means is we could expect to see that our hospital census numbers, our hospital positive COVID patient numbers, will also continue to come down over the next week or two, because the early indicator sign, which is those who test positive, has been coming down. So that's a good thing. As far as the reopening and the question around the yellow versus the red, you know, for us, one, let me recognize this is a tremendously difficult time for everybody. And in particular, I think the small businesses out there, and we see them in our community. Many of our employees are involved in them, friends and neighbors involved in those businesses. We know it's a tough time. But at the same time, we understand the lethality and the seriousness of this virus. And so I think the data-driven approach that the state has around looking at activity levels and trying to have a methodology where you color code different counties, I think that resonates with us. I think the phasing nature of how the reopening is scheduled is also something that resonates with how we've thought about even reopening our services, as I described. And so I think that is the right approach. And as far as our capacity, we manage that pretty tightly across our system. One of the things, one of the advantages of being a multi-campus system is that we have the opportunity and the ability to cross-leverage our capacity. And so if we're looking more full in one area, we're able to cross-transfer patients, both COVID and non-COVID patients, to other campuses in the interest of finding bed capacity, staffing capacity, supplies, and so forth. And so that's been how we've approached it. System-wide, we're very lucky, and we've managed things really, really tightly and diligently, and we do have bed capacity. That's something we'll continue to measure and keep track of as we're reintroducing some of these procedures and visits.
Next question is from the Milton Standard Journal and WNEP. Has Geisinger seen any children with symptoms of the inflammatory illness that has been seen in New Jersey and New York? How closely is Geisinger monitoring that situation in the event those symptoms do appear in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so the answer is very closely. And we have, thus far, we have not seen any of those cases in children presenting with COVID thus far. We are aware of the accounts of those types of presentations, both in the New Jersey area and other markets. I think it's picking up a lot of traction in the media and the news. I know there have been some segments just in the last few days, and even on the radio this morning. And so it's obviously very, very concerning. This virus, I think it's the science continues to emerge, and it's an area that it's presenting in different ways, and we're learning more as a society about how the virus behaves. And for those of you that have not heard, I think what this question is referring to is there's sort of this inflammatory, systemically inflammatory process that has been noted in some kids who have presented with COVID, kind of resembles or has been compared to a disease called Kawasaki's syndrome. And so we have not seen it thus far, but obviously are closely monitoring. And also our pediatric experts are in contact with their colleagues throughout the country as far as what has been shown to work or what are the right ways to approach and how are these kids presenting so that we're, you know, our antenna, let's say, are totally up on this one.
For the Press Enterprise, there's been some debate about whether nursing home COVID-19 cases should be considered among a county's cases when considering its reopening. Has Geisinger seen evidence that nursing home infections can cause spreading of the virus in communities that surround them?
Yeah, so this is, and we've been saying this for a while, nursing homes, all it takes is one flare-up, one outbreak, and we have seen that blossom very quickly in the local community, and we see the downstream impact on our hospitals when that happens. And so it's one of the reasons why we've been swimming upstream, so to speak, and really trying to partner with our nursing home partners. I mean, these are sites that we don't own and operate, but obviously we have a keen interest in making sure that that there's good PPE, that there's good training and education around how to use that, how to have appropriate testing and educating folks around that as well. And we've been doing all of those things. It's also important to remember that even prior to COVID, a lot of our clinical leadership have served as medical directors at the local nursing homes. And so we're lucky in that regard because we're able to partner with them in a really meaningful way. It's important for our patients because it's part of the care continuum. But in the event of a pandemic like this, it's also very important because we are really all in this together. And what affects our nursing homes ultimately affects our hospitals. What affects our communities ultimately affects our nursing homes and hospitals, and vice versa. So I think to the point that the question was asking around, do we see the outbreaks in the nursing homes affecting what's out there in the community? The answer is absolutely yes. As far as whether epidemiologically they should or should not be counted, I'll leave that to the epidemiology experts. But we know that tracking what happens in those environments makes absolute sense.
From WKOK Radio, Geisinger was featured in the Washington Post earlier this week and noted as being a leader in the use of plasma as treatment for seriously ill COVID-19 patients. Do you expect that use of plasma will actually save lives?
Yeah, so plasma, this is what's called convalescent plasma transfusions, and this is taking the plasma from folks who have recovered from the virus, transfusing them into folks who currently have the virus on the belief that the antibodies contained in that plasma would confer some sort of immune response or strength. It's an area that's still being studied. That's why it's undergoing a clinical trial, which we are participating in. That's why we have cases of convalescent plasma or serum use. At this point, we've transfused, I believe it's over 110 patients. So a decent number at this point that we've done. We'll only know as far as the effectiveness of that treatment when you compile all of the data. That's why clinical trials, they have a very strict methodology and they make sure to enroll at least a certain number of patients because you want to prove whether a treatment, whether in this case convalescent serum or in other cases medications or otherwise, you need to know whether the treatment is lucky or good. And that's a question that you got to figure out because you'd hate to use things that have simply been lucky because lucky things have a way of going through an unlucky phase and they also carry risk with them. So you got to make sure that something's good. And that's what's going on with the clinical trial. So we're in the process of doing that. We're actively involved. Dr. Gustav De Ritter, who was featured in the Washington Post article, he's been leading that effort for us. One of these nationwide experts trained out at Duke, just a phenomenal leader for us. And we'll have more to come on that. But at this point, it's unclear whether it's effective.
Along the same lines from the Press Enterprise, what treatments has Geisinger seen as being effective against COVID-19?
So I guess I should have just continued on that one. It's the same thing. We're involved in a clinical trial with a medication called sirolimab, which is also in a slightly different classification of drugs. And we're pretty, we're lucky because we've had a robust research enterprise here for decades. And that allows us to get plugged into these clinical trials that are happening nationally. And that allows us to bring these medications to the people that we serve here in central and northeastern Pennsylvania. And these are drugs that otherwise they would not have access to because it has to be done through the context of a clinical trial. I think at this point, it's still early. As I mentioned with the convalescent serum, that's why you do the trials, to compile the data, not just from our site, but from the other participating sites across the country, to get at the question of how effective, what does it impact, and is there a specific time period or a time course during the disease where it's more effective than others? For example, with convalescent serum, which was asked about in the previous question, it's believed that that's more effective the earlier in the disease course that you use it. With some other medications, it works the other way. So all of this still needs to be studied. I think it's worth a reminder that this virus really hit our shores in the last couple months. And so the science is still rapidly evolving. The good news is Geisinger is front and center of those efforts, which I think is why it got picked up by national media and so forth. But we're pretty involved. I think if you asked our physicians, what have they seen, they would say that some of these medications might have some hope. But I think as scientists, we're all waiting for the definitive data.